trust.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
God created rich people first, and then showed them the world they would own. And when they came to a field with thousands of headless bodies with torsos and hands like iron, God told them that the headless bodies were destined to be poor workers. The rich cried out, "But these heroes with their iron muscles will crush us." "Don't be frightened," answered God. "I shall place very small heads and brains on their bodies, so until they develop them, you've nothing to fear. Who are still the oppressors, the rich, who are still the oppressed, the poor. Your slavery is their liberty. Your poverty is their prosperity. Priests say that the poor must be content with their poverty and they'll find heaven hereafter. Idiots, cretinous rag pickers. My dog George has more sense. Don't you know that whilst you're gazing up at heaven, your pockets are being picked clean, your eyes are plucked out, and you're robbed of your birthright, blind to what is done to you? Christ's priest seized mankind in its cradle and broke the bad news, saying, "You shapeless stench, you can never be anything but filth. Your only chance of winning a pardon for being so filthy is if you bow low in perfect humility in the face of all the afflictions, sorrows, and injustices heaped upon you. You're poor, and you stay poor. That is how it is meant to be. Life is a bitter ordeal. Don't speak out. Just try and save your worthless soul. You won't be able to, but you'll give us less trouble by trying. And when the time comes for you to die croaking, the darkness will be as hard to bear as the daylight ever was. The church knows its business. It offers fear and punishment, not happiness, certainly not liberty, only servitude forever and forever. Religion is a liar and a cheat. Yet still you hunger for it. That's why you've sent for me, Jacques Roux, Mad Jacques, Red Roux, preacher of the poor, sower of sedition, subverter of all laws, a priest who saw the light of reason and now proclaims fellowship with all who live in dark dens and desolate places. It's fitting that I should preach perhaps my last sermon in a ruined church in the parish of St. Nicholas, Summer's End. I go before the tribunal tomorrow, charged with revolutionary excess. Now I am, it seems, too revolutionary for the revolution. And so it begins. When power rested in one man, King Louis, all sorts complained of oppression, and the nobility, middled, and moneyed men called on the poor to help. Together, we lopped off that top branch of tyranny, but the tree still stands and spreads. New branches hide the sun of freedom from the poor. The Revolutionary Tribunal is one such. I don't recognize its authority to judge me. Only the poor of St. Nicholas can do that. I come here to lay the rags and tatters of my life before my peers. Habits are hard to break, citizens. I come to confess me. Hear my confession. Do not forgive me, Father, for I have not sinned. My own father had 12 children, and as I was the cleverest, he rid himself of me by sending me to school at the Angoulême Seminary. At 15, I was ordained a priest when I knew even less about God than I know now. There was a priest on every dunghill. The scummier they were, the more they sprouted. But I stayed on and became professor of philosophy, teaching students to bear with fortitude the misfortunes of others. Like religion, philosophy solves the problems of the past and the future, never the present. In 79, the Angoulême students rioted over the agony they saw around them and killed a cook by accident. As a suspect teacher with ideas, I was arrested and imprisoned, though I had nothing to do with the incident. A month or so later, I was released. No trial, no inquiry. Authority had decreed it, and I had no say in the matter whether I was to be free or in chains. This is how fires are kindled. Afterwards, I spent 4 years in the chair of experimental medicine in Angoulême. But medicine proved equally useless. Physicians know even less than philosophers and priests gangrene together. They lie. They all lie. Isn't that so, Georges? You tell them. I've grown hoarse in the telling. In 89, I was given this poor parish of St. Nicholas, and I was born into the real world of starvation and misery, and I saw the horror and the hope, too, for the revolution burst over us, smashed the clamps that held us down and swept us up, up with its transforming power. We opened a book we'd never read, and on the first page was the word liberty. Listen. Listen. The revolution was born in violence. Revolutions must be violent. It's the only way to end the greater violence that keeps the majority of mankind in servitude. Do you think that those with privileges would give them up without a fight because you have a charming smile and the best arguments? Adjuro. Adjuro. I renounced my alliance to Rome and gave it to France. I became a constitutional priest, put off the mitered robes of privilege and put on the white robes of liberty. I still practice as priest and physician when called on, but I have to earn an honest living as a pamphleteer and municipal official. I live with a good woman, widow Pettit, born Elizabeth Hubert, once laundress to the rich, now my helpmate, soulmate, who sells my pamphlets, 2 sous a copy. We adopted a son, Emile, a sweet, sweet boy. No more of that. It's not for your ears or yours or yours. My only fear, citizens, is not death, but a life without them. Georges knows. We love them, don't we, Georges? I was elected a member of the commune and spoke for the poor. I told Robespierre, Saint-Just, Brissot, and the rest they could never be the revolution, just men and not to be trusted with power. Anyone with authority becomes an oppressor, a parasitic coat of filth on the hide of the common people. Between those who command and those who obey, there is only hate. Does it follow that I reject all authority? No, but I always keep my hat on in its presence. In the matter of bread, I consult a baker. In the matter of boots, a bootmaker. In a house, a builder. For special knowledge, I apply to a specialist. But I don't allow the baker, the bootmaker, or the builder to impose their authority over me. I listen to them with respect, the respect they merit, if any, but I keep the right to judge, criticize, and censure. Why should we treat politicians of whatever stripe, royal or revolutionary, any different? I listen to King Louis, Mirabeau, Lafayette the same way I listen to the baker and the bootmaker. Don't be fooled by those who try to set themselves above you. Always look at the bill they are presenting. You have to pay it. And criticize me too. People thought Citizen Mara and I were enemies because we were forever attacking each other. He called me an extremist. This from a man who declared 300,000 heads weren't enough, but we were never enemies, just revolutionaries doing our duty. Neither of us were popular with the legislators, but it's not my purpose to be popular. I'm here to sting. To stop me stinging, the assembly hired me to write the report of the king's execution. We didn't do that well, but you'll not squeeze one tear from my eye over the fate of a royal fool and his followers who talked of honor and died without it. To the boneyard with the whole crew. The rich we'll gobble up, tra-lee, tra-la, tra-lie, with truffles in the rump and oysters on each eye. I love the harp. That's how men and women should die, to the sound of harps. They're so precious. King Louis died to the sound of drums. As the recording officer, I went with Citizen Santerre to the temple prison to escort the king to the place of execution. Santerre brought a carriage and a guard of honor for the occasion. We drove through streets lined with citizens. They had three executioners waiting there, three, and 18 drummers. What extravagance just to kill one man. The knife fell, Louis's head fell with it. The crowd shouted, "Long live the Republic," and then I saw Citizen Santerre and the other revolutionary officials dipping their handkerchiefs in the king's blood. I wrote it all up in my report, but I was the only one who seemed disgusted by the whole spectacle. Invading armies were about to overwhelm Paris, there was civil strife in the Vendée, rebellions in Lyon and Bordeaux, and good men and women were dying everywhere defending the revolution, even as the traitorous Louis was dying on the scaffold. But the good and true had no carriages, no 18 drummers and three executioners. A Prussian sword in the belly, an English bullet in the chest, and falling face down in the mud was their end. That's how ordinary people die. Meanly. Without harps or even drums to play them out. But Louis, that useless toe rag of a man, goes in style, his anemic blood gathered up as something precious. A month later, remember, I led the attack on the Paris food merchants. I'm proud of that attack. Those in power condemn me for it, so I know I must have been right. We ask only for food, a home, a little ease, no more crying in the streets, bread, bread, for God's sake. We were at war, and so we accepted such hardships if they were equally shared, but they weren't. We were dying because of filthy bourgeois graft and greed. The slimy, rapacious, money-mad exploiters were hoarding food to raise the price on the open market. Our legislators wrung their hands, threatened with a whisper, and did nothing. So we flat bellies marched, smashed stalls, broke open shops and warehouses, and found the bread and meat and other foodstuffs they'd hidden in abundance. They asked us why we did it. We told them because we needed it. Citizen Mara said we should kill every merchant in sight. We may do with a few scores strung up in front of their own shops to encourage the others. And it did. The next morning, the food markets were filled again with fruit and vegetables, bread and meat. Like Jesus, we had performed the miracle of the loaves and fishes. We must appropriate the land and money from the rich who have it in excess and give it to those who need it and live in want. The only way to defend and save the revolution is by pushing it as far as it'll go and then further, and that's never far enough for me. Then Citizen Mara died. Steel through the heart, painless when he'd had such a painful life. I miss him. No one left to trust. That's why I agreed to become editor of his paper when his staff asked me to keep the bright flame burning. So when those impotent, excremental conformists Robespierre and the Jacobin gang banned women from political power, we took up the cause. They wanted liberty for themselves alone. I wrote that those refugees from the leper house of reaction should be belled and booted headfirst into the nearest sewer. In return, they persuaded Mara's widow, Catherine, to denounce me to the Revolutionary Tribunal for besmirching her husband's memory. Poor sweet Catherine. Grief takes many forms. She wanted to protect her husband's fame. She thought I was trying to take it from him in some way. I shun fame. It always costs too much. Late last night, I went walking through the streets of Paris with Georges, just the two of us. Georges padding beside me, sniffing every post and doorway, and me smoking my pipe. There's nothing better. Making love, perhaps, or making a revolution. But with a revolution, you have to be right. It was a clear night, and empty streets. And as we passed St. Nicholas's Church, something strange happened. I was walking, but suddenly I couldn't hear my own footsteps. Not one. Silence. I was a dead man walking. No more of that. Tomorrow, before the tribunal of mumblers, I shall make no attempt to defend myself. That doesn't mean I'll stay silent. Never that. I'll do what I was born to do. Attack! If the verdict of that bunch of rotting fish heads goes against me, I die like friend Mara. Though struck down by a better hand. My own. It's been a rich confession after all, friends, deserving of some penance, at least 5 Hail Marys and 26 Amens. After all, I've preached revolution and sedition, slaughtered a king and others, lived in sin, and will probably end even deeper in it by killing myself. In the eyes of the church, it's a 100% record of failure. But on Judgment Day, I expect to stand before my God justified. I do not condemn myself and shall not be condemned. And so, amen. If it's to be the last amen, I go gladly. My wife and son will weep, I know. And George here will howl a little, won't you, boy? My friends will pause, shake their heads, and move on. For they have the difficult part. Living well is so much harder than dying well. I have tried to help create a people who are skeptical, rational, critical, not easily fooled or impressed, in a word, a free people. Ungovernable. It's a dream, of course. But I've been lucky to have lived through times that made the dream seem possible. And just for a moment, we stopped being me and mine, you and yours, us and them, and saw ourselves instead as equals in our common humanity. We are of that generation that so transformed the world that future days and nights can never be the same. We poor, clumsy men and women turned the world upside down, inside out, round and about. One last word for my last sermon. The revolution isn't complete. Hardly begun. Defend it. Don't sit back. Act. Without action, no life. Without life, no perfection. Without perfection, no eternal peace and freedom. For God is an active power, and we do his work in fighting the great battles light against darkness, love against selfishness, revolution against reaction, life against death. Come on, George. Time for our walk.
I'm listening to CFRU 93.3 FM right now.
Do you worry about how much someone drinks?
Do you feel angry or depressed most of the time? Do you feel neglected or unloved?
Do you feel that if the drinker loved you, she or he would stop drinking?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are not alone.
Not everyone trapped by alcohol is an alcoholic.
Families and friends are suffering too.
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Call 1-866-200-0223 or visit alanon.org/help.
Today is Orange Shirt Day!
This is a message from Paisley Road Public School and St. Joseph Catholic School.
Why are people wearing orange shirts today?
Wearing an orange shirt on September 30th is a way to show you care about residential school survivors.
My teachers say they never learned about residential schools when they were kids.
I have learned over 150,000 First Nation, Inuit, and Métis children went to residential schools.
I hope everyone learns the truth about residential school so we learn from our mistakes.
Show you care about residential school survivors.
Wear orange today.
Every child matters. Today is Orange Shirt Day.
Why are people wearing orange shirts today?
Wearing an orange shirt on September the 30th is a way to show how you care about residential school survivors.
Did you know that 150,000 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit children had to attend residential school?
Did you know the last residential school closed in 1996?
I hope everyone listens to survivor stories so we can have a better future.
I want to tell kids and survivors, have faith in yourself.
Show you care about residential school survivors.
Wear orange today.
Every child matters.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Sorry about beginning so abruptly and just launching full force into that performance, which I just did. But it seemed just the most appropriate thing to do. That was The Preacher, a one-act play by Peter Barnes about the life of Jacques Roux, one of the most revolutionary, most radical figures, you could say even socialist figures, from the French Revolution. He was born in 1752 and died by suicide in 1794. And the reason why I wanted to do that probably is just because how I feel right now. How I feel. In the last few weeks, I've been talking about art and expressing revolutionary ideas through art, specifically through my own writing. And I'm still thinking about that. You know, just how I can express, you know, my rage, you know, my anger, my rage, my defiance, my indignation about the state of the world as it is right now. With regard to climate change, with regard to capitalism, with the rise of the far right, the rise of fascism, imperialism, colonialism. And of course, you heard the PSAs there. This is Orange Shirt Day. honoring the children who suffered in the residential schools. I'm wearing a orange ribbon now. All these things, how they interconnect, intersect, intertwine in this vast, disgusting web of oppression and exploitation that we see in the world today. And how do we resist that? How do we fight that? A lot of people are asking those questions. And a lot of these people, of course, they're at a loss because they don't know the history of how people actually have fought against these things in the past. True history has been kept from them. True means of organization and resistance have been kept from them. You know, whether that's because they've been blinded by white supremacy or they've been blinded by the Cold War or whatever. You know, living in relatively affluent conditions in the West. So they're blind to what people are doing in the Third World, you know, the former colonized people, how they fight for liberation. They don't know that story. They don't know that history. They don't even know the history of, like, student struggles, workers' struggles in their own countries. In many cases. So they're at a loss. I think they got to reinvent the wheel. And I detected some of that sentiment, of course, in some of the climate strike events I attended last week. You know, you have people who, maybe they're getting into activism for the first time, inspired by people like Greta Thunberg and, you know, seeing her brave example and the stand she's taking, you know, getting into activism for the first time, you know, because they want to protect their kids. Or they want to, you know, fight against this devastating thing, which is going to have is already having a destructive impact, such a destructive impact on humanity. And they see what's coming, but they don't know how they do this, how to fight back. They can't put this in context. And of course, it needs to be put in the context of anti-colonial struggle, anti-imperialist struggle, anti-capitalist struggle, and how that struggle has been panning out around the world over the last, you know, over centuries. So in many cases, what we have to do now, brothers and sisters, is reclaim history. And, you know, maybe one of the ways I can communicate that is through art. And to be honest, you know, like, this is, you know, I don't really have too much, like, in the way of music to really express this, so you're going to have to just bear with me. And I try to use my voice to express these things. One of the things the events I went to on Friday. On Friday, I attended one of the climate strike events. It was happening by the River Run Center in downtown Guelph. It's a relatively small gathering on the pier, you know, the concrete pier behind the River Run Center. And, you know, we heard from some indigenous voices, indigenous people speaking there. I originally wasn't going to speak myself, but I did end up speaking and saying a lot of things that I've said on this show, you know, about how I got into, how I became what I am. I mean, I talked about that last week. I talked about the people who inspired me, who educated me. You know, I talked about Mr. Walker, you know, the indigenous man who was a history teacher I had in high school. You know, of the Mohawk Nation. And I still remember, like, the pride in his voice when he said, you know, like, when somebody asked him if he was indigenous, he said, yeah, I'm Mohawk, Guardians of the Eastern Gate. That's how he identified himself. And the pride in his voice was just, it was really striking. And not something I'd really known before, something I'd seen before. And he was the one who really exposed the real history of colonialism in Canada, settler colonialism in Canada, to, you know, my young eyes. And, you know, like, educated me on that. You know, this white suburban kid that I was, who didn't know anything about this. Because, of course, we're not really taught effectively about this history. So much more needs to be done. But he really played a major role in, You know, he was a Marxist himself and played a major role in my radicalization. And I talked to the audience about that. You know, like I think I was among the last of the speakers. Originally, I wasn't going to speak at all. But I talked about this. I talked about the real history of like how whiteness was invented as a colonial mechanism to keep people in line, to keep working class people divided, oppressed people divided. As a mechanism of control by the colonial elite, which then spread around the world and became like a facilitator of empire everywhere. As the European empires went into Africa, went into Asia, and further into North and South America. And it's what traditionally has kept people of European descent from standing in solidarity with black and brown people, with indigenous people. This whole idea that people with light skin are somehow superior. You know, this myth, this destructive myth that was propagated originally to keep people of European descent and people of African descent from joining together in rebellion against rich plantation owners in Virginia at the end of the 17th century. That's why the first race laws were passed, is to divide and conquer those rebellions. That's a history we're not taught, and I've talked about it a number of times on this show. And I talked about it there. I talked about how Marxism, you know, communism has been a tool by working class and oppressed people used throughout modern history to liberate themselves from colonialism, from capitalism, from that oppression. And I pointed out how the life expectancy of today actually is, well, I should say tomorrow, it already is the 1st of October in China. But tomorrow, in less than half an hour, is going to be China's National Day, the founding of the People's Republic of China, the triumph of the Chinese Revolution in October 1st, 1949. Before the victory of that revolution, life expectancy in China was about 35 years for the average person, which is the same life expectancy that indigenous people have today on the streets of Toronto. That's what colonialism does to people. It sucks the life out of them, literally. That's what it does to oppress people. And you can say what you want about the People's Republic of China, but they've broken away from that colonialism. They've broken the legacy of colonialism. They have liberated themselves. They've created a new society. And Chinese people aren't dying at the age 35 anymore. In fact, their life expectancy in China is pretty much on par with life expectancy in Canada. That's how far they've come. After they embraced socialism and built a new society for themselves, and struggled to break that legacy of colonialism that kept them down. And it's the same thing in Cuba, same thing in Africa, in places like Burkina Faso, in places like Angola, Mozambique, places that had socialist revolutions. Same thing in Vietnam. You know, in the DPRK, you know, North Korea, all these places dealing with the legacy of colonialism, they fought back. They built something new against immense odds and still struggling to this day, just like the struggling in Venezuela and Syria to free themselves from the legacy of colonialism. And just like indigenous people in this country are struggling to liberate themselves, secure their self-determination. And I, for one, as a white man, understanding that my history, you know, the history of whiteness, is bound up in colonialism, that I was basically the white people were effectively created to be weapons of colonialism. And that's a role that I refuse to play. I will not go along with colonialism, white supremacy, or any of the kind of things that the increasingly the far right and these forces are promoting. In this age of austerity, they're telling us to, you know, they're telling anyone with light skin to blame their problems on people with darker skin. The same old lie, which destroys working class people and keeps them down. I'm not going along with that myth anymore, that lie, the lie of whiteness. And I will stand, you know, shoulder to shoulder in solidarity with indigenous people, with oppressed people, with working class people all around the world, in internationalist solidarity, as we struggle for revolution, for a new society, where all people will achieve liberation, and where colonialism, imperialism, capitalism, all these things are bad memories. And this is a poem I wrote recently about kind of how I feel about all this and what it's like to understand this history. It's called A Small Colonial War. I'm not marching anymore. Soldiers are not supposed to ask questions. Yet my mind is a pressure cooker boiling over with maddening queries. What am I fighting for? Where is my home? Where is my home when colonialism has made every land through which my blood runs foreign? Where is my home? When there is no escape from the roar of the drill sergeant nailed in my flesh. When there is no escape in a world shaped by the obscene rattle of the Gatling gun. Wherever my feet tread, in whatever land I choose to walk, my whiteness follows. Colonialism following in the wake of this unwilling colonial soldier. For I am the unholy weapon that I was forged to be. I was made to be gripped by the most evil plunderers and exploiters. The sword that can only be wielded by the blackest of hearts dressed in pale flesh. I was forged to serve the slave master and the plantation overlord, the robber barons, generals, and colonial governors. I was forged to be their ever-loyal weapon, their walking rifle, the bloody hand of the lynch mob and the policeman's baton, the unseeing eye and the unlistening ear. Such is my history. A history that keeps me chained regardless of how mightily I struggle. Whiteness, the monster, laughs at my feeble efforts, laughs at my pathetic attempts at defiance. Laughable that a weapon could defy its wielder. You are mine, the monster says. Your blood, your flesh, your rage, it's all mine. The infernal puppet master that dances on the bloody bones of ancient civilizations is amused. The puppet master that would turn me into yet another tool of genocide laughs at my inertia. Bathed in money and in blood, it roars out its orders, it screams its commands, it screams out who is and who is not human, it roars out who is or is not worthy of life. Kill them. Onward, Christian soldiers, circle up the wagons. Shoot them before they shoot us. These inhuman, monstrous black and brown hordes, you are only protecting what is pure and true. It was fated to be thus, it says. It was as inevitable as the color of your skin. Surrender. Do not resist. You cannot deny what you are. Yet no white flag appears. I do not surrender. I do not give in. Even though my resistance is but a feeble whimper, there is no cry of defiance as I force myself to walk away from my assigned post. I'm tired as I leave the wagon train I am terrified as I enter that which I was taught to view as a howling wilderness, the domain of cannibal savages. But now I understand that true monsters dwell in palaces, and they would never consent to lurking under dark trees. And the distant fires of those so-called savages look more inviting than these cold old wagons. And so I disappear from you, although my whiteness follows as a ghost. Nor am I alone in my desertion from this evil army of lost souls. I am not the only discarded weapon dragging itself into the unknown. I am just another discontented soldier in colonialism's rank and file. Another little monster gnawing at its privileged chain. Another discontented soldier with mutiny on his mind. And nothing will be the same when I return from the hills. That was called A Small Colonial War. It's that poem expresses how I feel about resisting white supremacy and the destructive role that whiteness has played in keeping people like me from standing in solidarity with indigenous people, with oppressed people, people of color around the world, and their struggles for liberation. And how it's necessary to fight against racism, to fight against that wall, that divide that prevents people of European descent from seeing and hearing the real stories, the real struggles of indigenous people, people of color, oppressed people around the world. And of course, that wall was erected by colonialism. There needs to be solidarity. That's really what I was stressing there. And that means crossing the line. That means breaking down the barriers. That means joining hands. Because, and this is very important, brothers and sisters, we're dealing with a surge of the far right in this country. We have the I saw today some Canadian People's Party signs in Guelph, in the streets of Guelph. I found that to be immensely disgusting to see those signs, to see the far right, this anti-immigrant party which wants to embrace basically the ideas of Donald Trump, embrace the idea of a border wall, cracking down on immigration, blaming China for the opioid crisis and not the big pharmaceutical companies, and basically trying to blame outsiders, so-called outsiders, for all the problems that Canadian people are facing right now. You know, this is classic fascism here that we're facing from these guys. And of course, they dress it up in like ideas, you know, arguments about security and prosperity and all this kind of stuff. These guys are bigots. Racial bigots. And seeing the local candidate for the People's Party speaking at the debate which happened at the Italian-Canadian Club, the election debate, last Thursday, was just a disgusting spectacle. He shouldn't have even been there. He shouldn't have been allowed in the room. He shouldn't have been allowed at that debate. This was the debate organized by the Guelph Social Justice Coalition. I confronted them about it afterwards, like why he was even allowed there on that. This guy who, of course, was breaking hate speech laws and was like, basically an open racist and was openly, pressing this far right agenda. That attacks whole categories of people. Attacks whole like groups of people. Anyone who's racialized. Attacks all them. Attacks immigrants. Why was he even allowed there to spew this hate and this and all this? Why did the Social Justice Coalition allow him to do that? Of course, I ran for the Communist Party in 2015. And back then, we didn't have this kind of far-right threat. And that debate in the Italian Canadian Club, you never saw anything like that. We never saw the far-right coming in and trying to hijack the whole thing. But these guys basically, these liberal guys who, organized this event basically facilitated the far right in this case. Liberalism facilitating fascism. That's happened before. And they always cover themselves in the name of fairness and like you need all views at the table and all this sort of thing. No, you don't. Fascists, the far right, always must be excluded. Because that's monstrosity, you don't permit that. Now, and to follow that up, I think I should follow that up with another poem. By a man who knew what fascism looked like. It's a poem by Bertolt Brecht, the great German communist poet. Who was forced to flee from Germany in 1933 after Hitler came to power. He spent the rest of it wasn't until like after the Second World War he was able to come home. He was forced into exile. And of course some of his colleagues weren't so lucky, they ended up in concentration camps. And I've performed this poem before at the Guelph Poetry Slam. And just, it really speaks to me about kind of where we're at now and the dangers that we're facing now. And why we need to resist this upsurge of racism and far-right propaganda that we see today. It's called To Those Born After. Truly I live in dark times. The guileless word is folly. A smooth forehead suggests insensitivity. The man who laughs simply has not yet heard the terrible news. What kind of times are they when to talk about trees is almost a crime, because it implies silence about so many horrors? That man there calmly crossing the street, is he already perhaps beyond the reach of his friends who are in need? It is true that I earn my keep, but believe me, that is only an accident. Nothing I do gives me the right to eat my fill. By chance, I was spared. And if my luck breaks, I am lost. They say to me, eat and drink. Be glad you have it. But how can I eat and drink if I snatch what I eat from the starving, and my glass of water belongs to one dying of thirst? And yet, I eat and drink. I would also like to be wise. In the old books it says what wisdom is, to shun the strife of the world and to live out your brief time without fear. Also to get along without violence, to return good for evil, not to fulfill your desires but to forget them, is accounted wise. All this I cannot do. Truly, I live in dark times. I came to the cities in a time of disorder, when hunger reigned there. I came among men in a time of revolt, and I rebelled with them. So passed my time, which had been given to me on earth. My food I ate between battles. To sleep I lay down among murderers. Love I practiced carelessly, and nature I looked at without patience. So passed my time, which had been given to me on earth. All roads led into the mire in my time. My tongue betrayed me to the butchers. There was little I could do, but those in power sat safer without me. That was my hope. So passed my time, which had been given to me on earth. Our forces were slight. Our goal lay far in the distance. It was clearly visible, though I myself was unlikely to reach it. So passed my time, which had been given to me on earth. You who will emerge from the flood in which we have gone under, remember, when you speak of our failings, the dark time too which you have escaped. For we went, changing countries often, more often than our shoes, through the wars of the classes despairing, when there was injustice only and no rebellion. And yet we know, hatred, even meanness, contorts the features. Anger, even against injustice, makes the voice hoarse. Oh, we who wanted to prepare the ground for friendliness could not ourselves be friendly. But you, when the time comes at last, and man is a helper to man, think of us with forbearance. Do not judge us too harshly. That's Bertolt Brecht right there. To those born after. And there was a poem, and I really want to conclude with this. The show tonight, this episode of Back in the USSR, with a poem I wrote, which was inspired by Brecht's poem there. To those born after, which I wrote. It was the first poem I wrote in like a few years, to be honest. I mean, I wrote it back in July, largely because I was thinking about these kind of things and just how pressing it was. Like, this was, I wrote this not long after, you know, a group of, you know, communists and anarchists were able to shut down an event that Maxime Bernier, the leader of the People's Party, the far-right People's Party, was going to have at the Guelph Youth Music Center back in July. We shut that down, stopped it from happening. But, you know, us facing up against these fascist forces, these far-right forces, you know, it kind of inspired this poem to those beyond the crossing. It goes like this. I exist in a time of monsters. Where to speak of one's own loneliness is utter blasphemy amidst a world of wreckage and cruelty. A world where tracing the patterns of reality reveals a picture so grotesque it makes the blood run cold. And so we dwell and take comfort in simulations, hiding behind our numb black screens as we seek to shield ourselves from the inevitable. But it will find you. The harshness of it all will find you. Even as we all search for the same fleeting tenderness and beg in vain for it to stay, for you are history. We are history, and history shows no mercy. The brutal world into which we are thrown screaming at our births is without pity. From the inevitable and normalized cries of children in no-fly zones, to the inevitable and normalized knock of the landlord posting that eviction notice, from profitable work schedules broken down into 10,000ths of a second, to those abandoned as surplus humanity. There are those who would cross the threshold, leave this twilight existence, bid the gates of a new world open, enter the uncertain darkness in search of a new dawn. Enter the void that exists between the strangulation of the old world and the promise of the new. But the journey is so far, and it is hard to live between worlds. So easy to fall into spaces without air on this alien journey into the unknown. To have one foot in the old and another in the new, and to be torn across that jagged line, like an ox on a fence, one struggles forward but at the same time is dragged backward, strong enough to survive, but unable to escape the crushing horrors that drove them to take this painful step into the unknown. The kind and just future we long for appears sickly and muted by this tortured present tense. We are all mired in filth. The filth of a sick society clings to us and pollutes us, like mercury poisoning the waters. Even as we strive to cast down that which sickens us, emerge from the cancer, and find the redemption we so desperately crave. But even the greatest survivor emerges from their disease hardened, and can only climb to the mountaintop and look upon a glorious future they will never live to see. Oh, how the men and women of that shining future would look back with pity upon the would-be revolutionary if they knew. Those of us down in the gutter who stare longingly at the stars we can never reach. But when that new generation is finally born, in a world of bright color and welcoming, loving arms, those born after need not trouble their dreams over us. For we will be but the stones beneath their dancing feet, the solid and secure foundation for their joy, upon which their happy thoughts should not be allowed to dwell, except to occasionally paint over our dull and faded faces with their own brightness, life, and laughter, retroactively making redemptive masterpieces from the broken pieces of our hard exteriors, beautiful smiles smoothed over the grim expressions that in our time we were forced to wear. By their gentle hands, our old fears and confusion become certainty, the unshakable courage of immortal heroes and young gods preserved forever in the laughter of our children. For when this new generation rises up, its feet planted firmly in the soil of the world of tomorrow, free from the monsters that haunt our dreams and menace our days, when they rise up, we drowned men and women who came before the flood, we who could not make the crossing into this new life, weighed down as we were by the boulders of that cruel old world, that the cruel old world has hung around our necks, they will not judge us too harshly. This has been a lot of poetry here tonight. You know, even a one-act play performed there. You know, at the beginning, of course, beginning of the hour, played, it was Peter Barnes's play, The Preacher, about Jacques Roux, French revolutionary. I did a couple of my own poems, and Bertolt Brecht's poem. It's been quite a ride, brothers and sisters, and like I'm pretty much exhausted now. So, just bear with me, you know. I'll be back again next week. Until then, you know, stay safe, stay strong, support each other, and keep the bright flame burning. Solidarity, brothers and sisters. You're listening to Back in the USSR. Join me next week at the same time. Until then, take care. All the best.
I'm listening to CFRU 93.3 FM right now.
Do you worry about how much someone drinks?
Do you feel angry or depressed most of the time? Do you feel neglected or unloved?